Memory is a kind of accomplishment. Part 6. This section previously opened with the clause, "I want to write briefly." It evolved very quickly into a more extended exposition about something I've had on my mind for maybe 15 years, mulling it over, thinking it through. I've never had the opportunity to write it all up and may never again, so I decided to do it now. The tenor here is different enough from the rest of the essay that you could, if you want, just skip to section 8 to pick up the ongoing thread of the narrative. In any case, I want now to write, no longer briefly, about something pertaining to memory as a way of setting up what follows, my goal all along, a discussion of that poem by William Carlos Williams. I'll begin with the term that may seem disconnected, misunderstanding. That chronic affliction of human relationships, both individually and collectively. I started to think about this when what I intended as an innocuous comment at a meeting among my program's faculty ruptured a relationship I was hoping to establish with a newly hired colleague. Briefly, as we were trying to figure out a collective identity among us, I remarked that my own formation was not stereotypical to the field, meaning it was unusual, almost out of bounds, and that needed to be accounted for. Our newly hired colleague took this to mean that her formation, which was more mainstream in that moment, was stereotypical, not as in recognizable in its context, but as in boring, weak, lacking originality. She was quite angry about that and responded aggressively. I knew right then from prior experiences of this sort that the misunderstanding at the root of this disagreement was irreconcilable. And it was. I think you can see why, based on your own experiences. The point of contention may seem, on the surface, to be merely a matter of definition. I meant the word in this way, you took it that way, isn't that funny? But for each of us, the definition we instinctively chose was vested in our identities, quite deeply so. Which means each of us would have to navigate across some very rocky terrain to find an equitable meeting place. You have a chance, an obligation even, to attempt that in a marriage or a family. It is almost impossible in a workplace where mutual contact is so hard to schedule. So I just sat back quietly, resigned to a misunderstanding I knew was intractable. A few years later, I was rereading I.A. Richards' The Philosophy of Rhetoric, I can't remember why, when I came to his famous statement that rhetoric should be a study of misunderstanding and its remedies. Richards is delivering the talks that became these essays in the mid-1930s, in the midst of all the angst in advance of World War II. You can feel almost palpably his deep anxiety about the fate of Europe, buried beneath, even built into, the discourse of his arguments. My sense, he never even comes close to saying this, is that he believes the ominous political disconnects of that moment remain negotiable. If only the major players can come to a collective understanding that their differences are the result of mutual misunderstandings, rooted more in language than substance, a matter of translation in a sense, a process rhetoric could facilitate. Richards had recently been working with his longtime colleague C.K. Ogden on a project called Basic English, a general introduction with rules and grammar. The goal of which was, in part, to generate a simple vocabulary of about 850 words that would, in their words, take away the redundancies of our rich language and eliminate the words that can be made by putting together simpler words. A lexicon that would, I take it, be more immune to misunderstanding. It's an inane project I can only make sense of in the context of the hysteria and paranoia of that historical moment. But it provides some context for what Richard's fears about the elusiveness of language and what he hopes rhetoric can accomplish. My instinctive and immediate reaction to Richard's subsequent assertion about misunderstanding, as I reread that sentence this time, remembering that moment where things turned in our program planning meeting, was, there is no remedy for misunderstanding. And I thought, further, that the key to peaceable relationships, if and when they were still possible, which they weren't in Europe in the mid-1930s, was to prevent the misunderstanding from becoming established in the first place. It took me a while to unpack all of this to my own satisfaction, as follows. One thing that helped was thinking about the way I learned students' names in my classes. I had an almost foolproof procedure for memorizing names during the first class session. Almost. One thing I noticed over time was that if I misremembered a name for some reason, it was very hard for me to dislodge it and replace it with the correct one. My mental process thereafter was something like reading those signs that warn you about not turning left at an intersection, the left turn signal with a red cross-banded circle around it. In order to process that information, I need first to think about turning left, then tell myself not to. When I learned a name incorrectly, every time I invited that student to speak, I would see the wrong name, have to cross it out in my head, and then use the right one. This would take maybe a second or two, a hesitation the student would notice, which is about how long it takes me to realize I can't turn left when I see those signs. My point is this. Learning the name incorrectly is like a misunderstanding. Once it is established, it can be worked around, but not removed. Relearning a correct name is a relatively simple matter of substitution. The correct name is inserted, but the wrong name still remains under erasure. Resolving the tension that arose between me and my colleague would be much more complicated than that. Not just negotiating the definitional ambiguity of stereotypical, but also the many other attendant ambiguities about disciplinary history and professional identity, including age, that might pertain to each of us personally. This could well take many long conversations, each of which had the possibility of further aggravating rather than pacifying the disagreement. Better, as I decided initially, just to walk away cold. No one misremembers a name intentionally, of course. They believe it is registered correctly. Just as no one intentionally decides to self-install knowledge that they know is false, they believe it is true. And no one believes that a misunderstanding is a misunderstanding when it is first ensconced in memory. They believe they have, in fact, understood. So, understood shares the same status in one's memory as correct and true, and is therefore just as intractable, no matter the accuracy of any of them. One of the most formidable tasks in resolving what one believes is a misunderstanding is persuading the other, or yourself, that it is one. And that's only the tip of the iceberg in terms of resolution, as I suggest above. So, what's the solution to this, I wondered. Here's what I came up with. First of all, ditch the simplistic binary structure of everyday interpretation, the presumption that one either understands or misunderstands, especially if you believe the former is most often the case, and the latter is an occasional exception. No one who reflects for even a few minutes on their relationships with other people, as they are negotiated via language, can possibly assent to that trivial generalization. In my experience, which may not be stereotypical, I admit, understanding seems a rare gift and misunderstanding a constant menace. And ditch the belief that resolving a misunderstanding is a matter for which either a dictionary, simplistically, or even rhetoric in its glories is all the equipment you will need. Other terms that cross my mind as potentially useful: tolerance, patience, willpower, faith, for a start, all things that come both before and after language. The way out of this conundrum for me was to invent and then learn how to use a new category called not understanding, a state of mind that keeps the judgmental side of the interpretive process always open and in play, a liminal state in which meaning-making has no final destination or endpoint, no place to put a period at the end declaring understood as the outcome. Misunderstood is, after all, just an aberrant form of understood. It may be a stretch to suggest that understanding is always, to some extent, also misunderstanding. But the more I think about that, the more I believe it to be true. What is imperative is continued listening, careful attention, constant adjustment, a lovely, to me, extended process of coming to know. In short, not understanding is not only not misunderstanding, it is the very means by which misunderstanding can be avoided. Part 7. There's a little headnote at the beginning of this section. In all my excerpts from Bakhtin below, I neutralize or feminize the pronouns. Not knowing Russian, I have no way of knowing whether the standard translation to the male pronouns in English is literal and necessary. But I've read enough of Bakhtin's work quite lovingly to believe he would approve of what I do, even if it might take a bit of dialogue for us to come to agreement on it. Two terms I borrow from Bakhtin's core lexicon. My go-to source in matters of this sort is Mikhail Bakhtin, most especially via his concept of the unfinalizability of human identity as he outlines it in Problems of Dostoevsky's Poetics, by far my favorite of his treatises. He introduces the concept this way, describing the distinctively realistic way Dostoevsky deploys his characters. He says, "They all acutely sense their own inner unfinalizability, their capacity to outgrow, as it were, from within, and to render untrue any externalizing and finalizing definition of them. As long as a person is alive, she lives by the fact that she is not yet finalized, that she has not yet uttered the ultimate word." In the mode of not understanding, there is never an ultimate word, and every externalizing definition is, by its nature, untrue. I like all of that. Bakhtin then generalizes it this way, as it applies to human life in the world. He says, "A woman never coincides with herself. One cannot apply to her the formula of A equals A. The genuine life of the personality takes place at the point of non-coincidence between a woman and herself. The genuine life of the personality is made available only through a dialogic penetration of that personality, during which it freely and reciprocally reveals itself." I especially like that baffling second sentence, which suggests to me that the personality of an individual can only be genuine when one is non-coincidental with oneself. a kind of radical freedom from the before and after in the moment, which is related to the A that was already there, but alters it into something non or extra A in the serendipity of the interaction, such that the formula A equals A cannot apply. Ever. As this might pertain more specifically to my term, not understanding, Bakhtin goes on to say, for it must be emphasized that in Dostoevsky's world, even agreement retains its dialogic character. That is, it never leads to a merging of voices and truths in a single impersonal truth, as occurs in the monologic world. In other words, or at least in my words, even the strongest forms of understanding as a mode of agreement must remain by their very nature unfinalized, always unfolding, and intimately personal on both sides of the dialogue. For example, had my colleague in the instance I described asked me what I meant by stereotypical, or had I been wise enough to foresee the potential for disagreement about that word and had explained how I was using it, or had I just chosen another word in the heat of the moment, the prospect for dialogue would have remained open, misunderstanding replaced by at least not understanding, if not agreement, which would likely take much more ongoing dialogue. That's not what happened, unfortunately. Bakhtin further extends the radical openness at the crux of our unfinalizable natures along a temporal axis this way. He says, nothing conclusive has yet taken place in the world. The ultimate word of the world and about the world has not yet been spoken. The world is open and free. Everything is still in the future and will always be in the future. There's a breathtaking sense of liberation that becomes imaginable here, the futural unfurling of non-understanding toward deeper and deeper forms of agreement along a timeline that might take hours to fully negotiate in a conversation, or years to develop in a relationship, or a lifetime to pursue in becoming, always becoming, via all of this outward reaching, through dialogue with the other voices of living people and the artifacts they create, more and more oneself. Or less and less oneself, which, for Bakhtin, may amount to the same thing. This is not to say that we can't know things, believe things, assert things, or commit to things. It's just that all of those states of mind must have a provisional aspect to them. An openness, not only to further inquiry in their proper arenas, but also to alternative ways of knowing, believing, asserting, or committing. It is the very foundation for critical thinking, which is why I suppose so many fundamentalists who presume an eternally finalized position are so antagonistic to any mode of teaching or learning that includes the word critical. A critical mind is not weak or wishy-washy or unprincipled or, worst of all, woke. Just the opposite. It is vivid, alert, responsive, open to change, dreaming while awake, which to me and Bakhtin means it is still alive, not yet dead. We live in an historical moment in which politicians and pundits operate with the currency of alternative realities, intentional misinformation, and outright lies. This is the ideal environment to promote ignorance as a substitute for learning. The ultimate form of this aberration is the cult, a delusion in which incorrect is correct, false is true, and misunderstanding is understanding. All perfectly insulated from rational critique. A truly critical mind, one that feels comfortable in the liminal realm of not understanding, as I've described it here, is rarely fooled by shabby rhetorical ploys and rarely deluded by ideological propaganda. We also live in a moment where the term science is bandied about as an antidote to misinformation, sometimes a problem of its own. There is a tendency these days to valorize science as the guarantor of universal truth, and technology as the go-to problem solver, a misguidedly stereotypical Western bias. I will, I admit, take science over politics as a guide toward right thinking any day of the week. But many turn science into just another avatar for religion, the repository for truth, reductively conceived. If you spend any time doing some scientific work, and it doesn't have to be studying quantum mechanics or quasars, just everyday things like thinking about climate change, or a favorite animal species, or the nighttime sky, with a willingness to read books and watch documentaries, you will quickly enter the state of mind I just described, an excited awareness of not understanding as the foundational condition for further learning. Professional scientists, the best of them in any case, say over and over that the more they learn about whatever systems they happen to be studying, subatomic particles, cosmic events, weather, animal behavior, trees, rocks, insects, you name it, the less they know and the more they want to learn about their subjects. The Western scientific tradition, in its popularized forms, tends to promote paradigmatic delusions like fact or data or information as equivalents of true. Newtonian physics is a good example. It purportedly worked always and everywhere, and it did for a long time, until that pesky speed of light thing came along, requiring an Einstein to resolve it. And post-Einstein, there are a dizzying array of competing theories seeking to account for what his system can't. Will this process ever end? I hope not. In the same way, I hope my own process of using not understanding as a way to promote insight and self-change will never end. Coming to a stop in that sense is, to me, basically being already dead, as Bakhtin implies. There are, of course, situations and people and words and sentences for which we can simply declare an endpoint, a way of saying for any number of very good reasons, from deep revulsion to a paucity of time, we already know everything we want to. The outcome from that position is still neither understanding nor misunderstanding. The arguments between those two tend to remain most contentious precisely in those situations. One simply chooses to conclude the process of coming to know and move on, an affirmation of the value of not understanding. In the end, then, understanding becomes merely a form of misunderstanding about things we commonly agree on or just don't want to think about any longer. Even with Ogden's ultra-stripped-down dictionary, there was no universal consensus about a word or the new syntax it was situated in actually meant, not least of which because he posited English as the foundational world language, an assertion of colonial privilege that I'm sure he was incapable of understanding. And then, the fact that words, even the simplest, don't have, and never did have, by their figurative nature, a unitary definition. That is, I admit, an inordinately long transition to the next phase of my essay here. But it is something I've been wanting to write up for years, for myself, if for no one else, just to frame it out as a foundational philosophical, ethical, rhetorical position. And now I have. I may even go back and announce these two sections as an optional read, one you could easily have skipped over to get to the end of the line here. Okay, I just did that. So if you heeded that guidance, you're not reading this sentence. If you didn't, it's time to get on to the next one. Part 8. Now, back to my main track, and finally, to William Carlos Williams. About a month ago, kind of serendipitously, almost offhandedly, in the midst of a conversation I was having with a friend via Zoom, she talked briefly about a little piece of jewelry she had seen in a store many years before and hadn't purchased, something she came to regret more and more over the time intervening. Memories of that sort are not what I'd call traumatic, but they can be haunting and troubling nonetheless, generating regret. I have no problem with regret as a response to memory, as long as it can lead to some change of behavior and then redemption in the current moment. This one for her, and many darker and deeper ones for all of us, don't offer that prospect. What has been lost cannot ever be recovered. The mistakes, if in fact that's what they are, that led to that loss, cannot ever be rectified. I found all of this quite poignant, a kind of metonym for all the many deeper and more painful losses we carry in memory that arose not from what we did, but what we decided, often for many good reasons at the time, not to do. I didn't say much about this right then, but it stuck deeply in my memory of that conversation, enough so that I decided to do something myself in response to it. I thought if I could find a general semblance of that piece and send it to her, it might precipitate a process of recovery. Again, not in relation to a piece of remembered jewelry, but in relation to the regrets that afflict her and all of us most deeply. So I searched online, found something I thought might be an adequate semblance of the piece she described, bought it, and sent it to her. Our relationship is not an obvious jewelry-buying one, if you know what I mean. I have learned through experience what my age makes me ineligible for with women considerably younger than I am, so I am quite attentive to and careful about and respectful of boundaries and situations of that sort. I knew that sending this piece could end in a misunderstanding about all that, but I did it anyway, hoping the gift would be seen more as a dialogue opening than a transgressive gesture. I figured that the rhetorical ambiance I created for it was the key, so I spent some time thinking about that. That's how and why I came back to William's great poem. I offer below here the note I enclosed with the piece to provide the context for my sending it, which then provided the context for my thinking about the poem, which then animated me to start writing this essay. All these things I see now in the poem that would never have become visible to me were it not for this incident, a new layer of meaning, and what I might have not only to say about it, but to do with it. Life is full of risks, as are relationships. After my wife passed, I was riven with regrets that I have had to come to terms with over the years, and more remain. Many, maybe most of them, I realized, were vested not in something I did, but something I didn't. What we do can, of course, be hurtful, but we can often then acknowledge and apologize for it. Or it can be misunderstood, a state of confusion in a relationship that, as I've explained, can, over time, be clarified in an enduring partnership, like a marriage. But quite often, in less durable relationships, it can never be fully resolved. Just one of the costs of doing business in this life is how I think of it now. What we don't do is a void that is much harder to escape from. So now, when risks of that sort, related to doing or not doing, arise, I prefer to do, and damn the consequences. If apology doesn't work, there is misunderstanding. I can live with that much more easily than regret. So I sent the gift. Here's the note I sent to accompany and explain it. No whiteness lost is so white as the memory of whiteness. That's a passage from William Carlos Williams' poem, The Descent, and it suggests the incomparable clarity and poignancy that inheres to beautiful, lost things remembered. I know that nothing can override the memory of the piece of jewelry you didn't buy way back when. But sometimes there are comparable things that can at least take the edge off the angst such memories incite. Williams also says, right before the above lines in that poem, "No defeat is made up entirely of defeat, since the world it opens is always a place formerly unsuspected, a world lost. A world lost, a world unsuspected, beckons to new places." I hope your heart will open to many new places without compromising your memory of the older ones lost. Paul. The poem I quote from is one Williams wrote late in his career, late in his life, a time of some difficulty and deep reflection for him in terms both of what was experienced and what was lost. A poem published as a standalone and also absorbed into his epic, Patterson. It has always been a favorite of mine, which, like an octopus, changes its shape and color depending on where and when I happen to be reading it. Here are the opening lines. "The descent beckons as the ascent beckoned. Memory is a kind of accomplishment, a sort of renewal, even an initiation, since the spaces it opens are new places inhabited by hordes heretofore unrealized of new kinds, since their movements are toward new objectives, even though formerly they were abandoned." Memory, especially at my age, feels quite often like a descent into the past first, to the extent that anything accurately survives the ways in which we archive and then transform it over time, away from what's here and now to something that was there and then. This process, William says, is a kind of accomplishment, a sort of renewal. Not exactly either of those things, just like them. It is more accurately, he finally affirms, an initiation, with all of the ceremony, the pomp, the fear, the excitement, the disappointment inherent in such experiences. Like any initiation, it opens spaces that are truly new places, places that didn't previously exist, even in the original moment when the experience was first cached. And each return to those spaces brings forth new kinds of hordes heretofore unrealized. Memory, then, at least of things consequential, is never simply eidetic, the recovery of an isolated artifact left long in storage. It is more a portal that opens into a complex array of associations which varies often considerably over time, a web of connections that cannot ever be fully predicted beforehand. Sometimes, as Williams implies, memory can even have a futural aspect, opening toward new objectives, interestingly to me, even those that formerly were abandoned. Everyone harbors hordes of such memories, some of which recur repeatedly and feel in their emergence like deep loss. Mistakes made, opportunities forsaken, or more commonly, never even recognized in their actual moment. The feelings of poignancy or sadness associated with memories of this sort may have some existential value, adding dimension to life in the moment, but in my view, very little. The key is what we do with such memories, what we make of them, not retrospectively but forwardly, the way we use their intrinsic lament to change right now for good and toward the good. When memory is redeemed in this way, it becomes revelatory in the sense that we can now see and will continue to see an array of values and experiences, often tiny ones, that were previously invisible. We'll cherish certain analogous things that come our way instead of dwelling on what is past, has passed beyond reach. The former path is deep contentment, even joy. The latter is misery, even despair. That is what I think Williams is trying to work out, to deal with, to renegotiate, actually, at this latter moment in his life as he looks back, not so much on the people and things he simply left behind, but on the people and things he didn't properly value. The people and things he took for granted instead of loving. In other words, memories of things lost, when properly resurrected, can be redeemed from uselessly nostalgic regret to increase our capacity to love right now. I'm removing part 9 from the audio version of this book, and I may end up removing it from the textual version of the book as well. It's quite long, and it seems to me now going over it to be less connected to the overall argument of this essay. So, part 10. So how does this apply to the memory of things you left behind? Well, you have two choices. You can lament that loss over and over regressively, or you can cherish what remains of that relationship, using it as a reminder to attend more carefully to all the other beautiful things that cross your path, only a few of which are destined to become yours in a permanent way. The piece I sent my friend cannot ever compete with the memory of the one she left behind. By that measure, it is a mere semblance, a figment, a sham. As Williams makes clear, the memory of whiteness is always whiter than any right now white. I knew all of that. But it shouldn't have to, and has no desire to, compete with memory in that way. Only to enrich it. Dealing with the loss of any sort of loved person, place, thing is a risky business. If you expect the next and new person, place, thing to replace what was lost, they will always come up lacking. Memory is incomparably formidable in that paradigm. If, on the other hand, you use memory to enhance your capacity to see and value what is next and new for what it is, on its own terms, it will open new places heretofore unrealized, each of which will not be trivial or disappointing, but will add a new layer of meaning to the original memory. In this case, the gift I sent may allow my friend to see that now she has both the piece she left behind and this new one that her story brought forth from the oblivion of that moment in our conversation. Two instead of one. That's a pretty good deal. I can see, having written this, something I hadn't seen previously about both the gift and my friend's decision to leave the original piece behind. Not taking something is not the same as not doing something. Not taking is, in fact, a form of doing, a choice. An object for sale in a store is not, of course, a leaf on a tree. It does not intrinsically belong to its habitat. It was made to be taken. Still, had my friend bought that little piece, it may by now be languishing at the bottom of a box of such purchases, or lost, or just forgotten. She has no way of knowing what its fate became. But it could have been a good one, with someone who would cherish it forever. That is always our best hope for the things we encounter with love along our way here. Not that they come home with us to stay, but they will always find a cherished home to share with those who cherish them. I didn't hear from my friend for several days after I knew via USPS tracking that the package had arrived, which made me a bit anxious that the gift had been misunderstood and our relationship would have to stumble past that going forward. But I believed good would come of it somehow for both of us. And it did. The very next day, we Zoomed in a normal way. She appreciated the gift and what it represented. She is so smart. I have no idea why I worried she might not. As it turned out, the piece I bought did not resemble the remembered original. But facsimile was not the key to its purpose, which was to displace a memory, not to replace an object. It's possible that throwing it out might accomplish that more effectively than keeping it, an embodied gesture of cleaning house, as it were, of attachment to regret. That will be up to her to decide. Oddly, in the end, the main beneficiary of this transaction might turn out to be me, in that it has helped me to think about that very process of severing attachment to my own regrets. And as added bonuses, it inspired me to reread The Descent from a new point of view, to find out about the Everywhen, to revisit Bakhtin, to think more deeply about dreaming and memory, and to write this essay, each of which points me toward the future, not the past, all of which were wonderful and worthy uses of my time and energy during the darkening days leading up to this year's winter solstice. Today, the light starts coming back. Just a couple extra minutes of it, maybe, but a kind of accomplishment, a sort of renewal, which is what the future always is. Very cool. Part 11. Williams ends his great poem this way. With evening, love wakens, though its shadows, which are alive by reason of the sun shining, grow sleepy now and drop away from desire. Love without shadows stirs now, beginning to awaken as night advances. There are many things, relationship-wise, that age makes one ineligible for. But love, in its truest and deepest sense, is not one of them. It awakens in the evening as brightly as it did all day, in some ways more so, free of its shadows, which drop away from desire as night advances. I try to imagine what love's shadows are once they grow sleepy, and what this has to do with desire, which must be what animates them while the sun shines. And all of a sudden, I find myself reaching toward new objectives, even though formerly they were abandoned. And then, the descent, made up of despairs and without accomplishment, realizes a new awakening, which is a reversal of despair. For what we cannot accomplish, what is denied to love, what if we have lost in the anticipation, a descent follows, endless and indestructible. A descent, downstream, all that row, row, rowing, going on down below in the body gently and up top in the brain, where life is but a dream. How memories of all kinds are made, making us who and what we are uniquely, not what we cannot accomplish or have lost in anticipation, those things denied to love, but a constant awakening to the quickening stream, the path we make as we follow it, love without shadows, endless and indestructible. What could be better than that at any age?